Good evening, everyone. Hello?
Hello.
I'm David Alkak. Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum.
Put the mic up.
Put the mic up.
And I'd like to see if there are any newcomers, anybody that's been here. Ah, very good. How did you hear from us? About us?
I saw the group on Meetup.
At Meetup?
Yeah.
Very good.
And I'm interested in the topic, and I see you're group in the Dallas Philosophers Forum. So
yes. Well, good. Our topics aren't always philosophy. Tonight it's more or less economics and history. We've had all kinds of topics. So, and
hold the mic up.
Okay.
He's a damn shout.
Here's a schedule of our topics, and this goes through May, and then we can take off for the summer, and then reconvene in September. So tonight, first, a few little housekeeping things. If you've eaten, make sure you take care of your bill, and take care of the tip for the wait staff. I guess we've covered about everything. Tonight, we don't have the speaker that's scheduled. He had a conflict of scheduling and kind of canceled. And so we are indebted to David Drum, past president of the Dallas Philosophers Forum, who has graciously substituted and has agreed to talk tonight. And David has been around a while. He's past president of this organization. He was born in Dallas. I won't give you the year. Went to the University of Texas at Austin, where he got a BA in cultural anthropology, summa cum laude. Went to SMU Law School and was editor of the Southwestern Law Journal. I guess you've been he's been in Dallas ever since. He's a partner in the his law firm of Carrington, Coleman, Sloman, and Blumenthal, where he specializes in real property and oil and gas. He's been a speaker at many forums, and including our own here, from time to time, on law and related topics, and many others. And he gives classes regularly at his Unity Church of Dallas, and I've attended several of his classes there. Very good teacher. He's on the board of trustees of the Hatton Summers Foundation, and he's been chairman of that since 2011. And so David's going to talk to us tonight about the historical basis of money and debt. A little history. Coins that you find in your pocket weren't actually invented or started until about 500 BC. So you may wonder, well, what did they use for money before that? There's been all kinds of things that are money. I mean, cockle shells and gold and now paper. We use paper for money. And he's going to also talk about debt and credit and all about that sort of thing that we take for granted, but our whole world kind of evolves around that. So without any further ado, David.
Thank you, David. In presenting this material, I'm going to be drawing very liberally on a book by David Graeber which is called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. So I want to acknowledge that source. This will not be a book report. I'm going to take this in a little bit different organization than Graeber presents it in his book. But nevertheless, I want to make full attribution of the ideas. Although many of the ideas were ones I was exposed to as an anthropology student back in the 70s. But I think Graeber's done a good job of sort of bringing some of these back into the mainstream conversation. I guess you can call it mainstream, but at least the mainstream egghead conversation, let's say. You know, people that read books. I'm not sure it's the Twitterverse, but it's the mainstream to some of us. And the interesting thing about David Graeber is he also is an anthropologist. In fact, he is the resident anthropologist at the London School of Economics, and so his job primarily is teaching anthropology to economists, which I think very nicely kind of sets up the approach here, because normally, if you wanted to understand, you know, what is the real meaning of money, what is the real meaning of debt, you might think you would go ask an economist. You know, they would have the best grounding in that subject. And maybe that's right. But a lot of the pure economic theory on this subject is drawn from writers such as Adam Smith, you may be familiar with. He wrote his primary work, The Wealth of Nations, in 1776, which is easy to remember because that's the year of the Declaration of Independence. He, very much like the political philosophers who were active in that same era, Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, would imagine how things such as social contracts, political institutions, money had originated. And this was really prior to the development. This is kind of the birth of economics as a discipline. But it's prior to the development of anthropology as a discipline, because anthropology didn't really come on its own until the next century, the 19th century. And anthropology draws primarily from archaeology, from the study of artifacts, but also from ethnology, which are the study of living peoples, to try to make generalizations and conclusions about the evolution of some of these ideas. And I think what comes out is that what Adam Smith theorized may not necessarily line up with the anthropological research in the area. And that doesn't mean that economics cannot be useful, you know, for certain applications. But I think it does mean that if you try to extend the economic view to a wider purpose than maybe constructing some models to study particular behavior and certain kinds of markets and that kind of thing, you may be a little bit off the mark. Okay, let me go into a little bit more depth about what I mean. What Adam Smith postulated is that money must have originated from the fact that early humans would naturally be bartering things with each other. You know, you would imagine these primitive people living in some kind of society, a village, or, you know, who knows. Sometimes it's a little bit vague. But you know, Joe would be growing the cabbages, and Henry would be tending the pigs. And so, you know, Joe would bring his cabbages to Henry, and they'd sort of dicker a little bit, and they'd say, you know, 4 cabbages for a pig, no. 5 cabbages for a pig, and, you know, they make a deal. But that's kind of cumbersome, because what if Joe has the cabbages, but he really doesn't want the pigs? You know, he wants the, you know, the feathers from across the valley. You know, how does he get those? He's got bumped into the person that has exactly what he wants. And so the theory goes, the economic theory goes, well, money was invented to be this thing that can be exchanged, you know, for anything, and so you don't have to trade with somebody that has what you want. You just, you know, trade with somebody, they give you money, and then you go give that to who has what you want. And so basically the supposition was you had barter first, and then you had money as this medium of exchange, and then at a later stage you had debt and credit, because you know, you maybe you might be a little short, and you, you know, you'd say, you know, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger now, you know, Wendy from my childhood. And so you have debt. But actually, the anthropological research supports a different order of things. And I'm going to kind of go into some detail about that rather than sort of give away the punchline on that. So let's start with some basic definitions, which I'm adopting Graver's. And let's start with what is the difference between a debt and an obligation? Graver's, and you can think of an obligation as a moral obligation, a social obligation. You know, I need to take care of my parents in their old age. You know, I need to provide for my children. You know, I need to, you know, render aid to a neighbor in distress. You know, we think of those things as our obligations. What makes an obligation a debt is the fact that you can put a price on the obligation. You know, it's kind of like the American Express, you know, commercial. You know, some things may be priceless. You know, you wouldn't think of putting a price on them. An interesting application of that is there is an apparently true story that Graver cites of a man when he was 21 years old. His father presented him a bill for his upbringing, including the cost paid to the doctor for the delivery. Even more strangely, the man paid the bill. But needless to say, father and son didn't have anything to do with each other after that. And so that's kind of a strange way to think of that kind of obligation. Even though we might say they're filial obligations, we normally wouldn't put a price on it, and we wouldn't expect it to be settled as an account is settled. And so, to Graver, that's exactly what makes an obligation a debt, is that you can denominate it and put a quantity on it. And so money then becomes simply defined as what you quantify the debt with, what you measure it in, just like you might measure a length in inches, you know, or miles or something like that. Then money is a way of quantifying that debt, and not necessarily correlated with some metal or some object that's exchanged. It can be, and even today, a lot of our money, you know, we get our accounts from our brokers and our banks and all that. That money only exists as, you know, zeros and ones in electronic space. I mean, you know, that somebody is giving us that value of credit. You know, it's not necessarily sitting there in a coin. So if you start with that definition of money, and then you want to look at the historical story for how it really emerged, you know, how did we come to have money, you start with the fact that for most of human history, all humans were hunter-gatherers prior to the invention of agriculture, and they were in bands of, you know, somewhere between 0 and 250 people each, and that was really the community that humans deal with. The anthropologists are able to study some living hunter-gatherer societies. They're harder to find, and you have to make allowance for the fact that they've all been exposed to, you know, other peoples who aren't hunter-gatherers, and so they're not really pure and pristine, but they're still probably the best study you have. And so hunters and gatherers such as Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert, Pygmies in the African rainforest, the Inuit or the Eskimo in the Arctic regions are some examples. They've been studied for how they really behave, you know, economically, so to speak. What you find is that a hunter-gatherer band is organized economically around concepts that we would recognize as the definition of communism, which is to each according to his needs, from each according to his ability. Now, you know, that's kind of a loaded word, and that kind of communism doesn't have anything to do with
Leninism, Stalinism, Maoism, you know, any of the historical, that's a pure, you know, ideal basis of defining communism. But that is how hunter-gatherer tribes deal with exchange, is that if one of them is walking around, and if I say to David, nice shoes, you know, David would have an obligation to take off those shoes and give them to me because I've just expressed my need. He's able to satisfy my need. And that's the way it works. And it works fairly well in a community of that size. And one of the stories in the anthropological literature that illustrates
that
this...
Is that just an obligation of you to pay me back?
Yeah, they're reciprocal. I mean, it's not it's not hierarchical, but it's also not measured and balanced. You know, it's not necessarily that, you know, I gave you, you know, $100 worth, but you only gave me 40. You know, it's a matter of what's needed at the time and what's asked for and what you. But it definitely is reciprocal. It definitely goes both ways. So. There's a story about a Danish writer named Peter Freuchen who wrote a book, I think probably in the 1920s or 1910s, called Book of the Eskimo. And he tells about his experience of trying out his hand at walrus hunting, which is what you do, you know, when you're an Eskimo. And he had been hunting all day and came up empty. And so he was sitting around wondering what he was going to do for dinner. And one of the successful hunters came by and dropped off several hundred pounds of meat. And so quite naturally, Mr. Freuchen began to thank the man. You know, we think that's just normal. You would thank someone for doing something like that. Well, guess what the man's response was? He became very indignant. And he said, up in our country, we are human. And since we are human, we help each other. We don't like to hear anybody say thanks for that. What I get today, you may get tomorrow. Up here we say that by gifts one makes slaves, and by whips one makes dogs. Okay, so what he's saying is that you know, you can't record that obligation as something that I had, you know, a choice to do or not do. I mean, it simply is, I had the food, you needed the food, I gave you the food. And for you to suggest that we're going to now, you know, you're going to owe me one for that, we don't want to go down that road. And a little bit later in the history, we'll sort of see why they didn't want to go down that road. Because it creates a debt that might possibly not be able to be repaid. And then you have to deal with the consequences of what happens if you have a debt that can't be repaid. And so in the primitive societies, they don't want that. You know, now if somebody is simply not being reciprocal at all and not playing by the rules, then they will simply, when they go to the next hunting ground, they simply will not, you know, leave them behind. You know, I mean, they have their way of dealing with that if they're not fitting in with the rules. But it's not by keeping a tally and keeping an exchange. So that's, you know, unlike the fictions of Locke or Hobbes or any of the theorists who sort of theorize kind of what, you know, pristine human society, original human nature is, you know, that's our best evidence of really how humans behave economically. And unless we think that's only a thing of the past, we still have what's called baseline communism sort of in our DNA, so to speak. That comes out in certain respects. For example, if we are in a work environment and all working on a project and somebody needs to use the copier or somebody needs, you know, to borrow the car, when we're on a team effort and trying to get the job done, you know, we're not tracking, you know, well, okay, you used the car too much or you've used too many paper clips or, you know, we just, it's what do you need to get the project done. You know, we're all in this together. Similarly, in times of great stress, you know, think of all the stories about 9/11 in New York. when people are under extreme conditions, they will revert back to this kind of baseline communism, and really, you know, you, no questions asked, you know, you do what's necessary. On the other extreme, on the very trivial, if someone stops us on the street and asks for directions, you know, or I'm not a smoker, but, you know, smokers will typically, you know, allow someone to bum a cigarette off of them, you know, or give someone a light, you know, and they're not, you know, it's because, so it's both extremes. It's either real, you know, real life-threatening, or it doesn't really matter. We sort of have this, you know, kind of baseline communism, so to speak, in our DNA. But obviously that's not the whole story with what goes on with us, but it is nevertheless part of the picture. So let's move forward then to, from these hunter-gatherers to the first village agricultural communities, because that's the next stage in cultural evolution, is agriculture is discovered, and so people need to stay in one place for longer, so they'll be there for the harvest and can protect their labor and planting and tending the crops, and so villages arise, you know, where people gather. And what you find is, and so now, and also with village agriculture, the population intensity grows by a factor of somewhere between 60 and 100-fold in terms of how many people are living on 1 acre of land. And so there's simply less elbow room, and, you know, people kind of bump into each other more, and there's more social friction, so to speak. And what you see developing in these village agricultural societies is what Graeber and others call a social currency, which by some theorists was mistaken for true money, but it doesn't meet the definition of a quantification of debt, and therefore I would submit it's not real money. What am I talking about? I'm talking about things like wampum in Native American communities. Cowrie shells were used in certain places. There are, you know, usually it's there rods, brass rods in certain societies. Generally, it's some kind of adornment, something that can be, you know, kind of worn on the body and is sort of festive and takes some effort to manufacture, you know, and to make up. And what has been discovered about these social currencies is that they are used in exactly the situations, like the story about the father and the son, that we would normally not think of being something money could buy. Specifically, they're most prominently used in exchanges for marriage partners and for retribution of wrongful death cases in the tribe. And so, in one of these village agricultural societies, it would be customary, for example, if a daughter of one clan is taken in as a wife of a son of the other clan, to pay what's called bride wealth or bride price to the village that's supplying the daughter. Why? Because in this society, the labor is still the scarce resource. There's a division of tribes that have what's called bride price, where the bride's family gets paid, and those that have dowry, where the groom's family gets paid. And the division is exactly on the lines of whether the scarce resource is labor or the scarce resource is land. If the scarce resource is labor, then the wife's family gets compensated because they're providing the fertile womb that will, you know, hopefully and presumably lead to more people that can, you know, till the soil and that kind of thing. If the land is the scarce resource, then the wife is just viewed as another mouth to feed, and so you need to pay, you know, you need to pay the person that's having to foot the food bill, which is which is the groom's family. So those social currencies are not utilizable to do things like buy eggs, you know, buy pigs, you know, but those are still on, you know, kind of a tribal, you know, version of the kind of the hunter-gatherer system. But these currencies are used, like I said, to pay bride wealth. when the UN got involved and they were trying to, when the UN got involved and they were trying to figure out if this was humane or not, they were saying, was this dry well, does that mean you're really buying the woman? And really, anthropologists and ultimately the UN decided not, because the distinction is you couldn't resell the woman. You know, you can, unlike, say, a slave in the southern U.S., you know, you didn't have, quote, property rights in that woman. It was only a kinship relation, and the only recourse would be really to send her back to her home village. You know, you couldn't, like, say, okay, we're selling her over, you know. So it's not really quite slavery. The other circumstance these social currencies are used is if, you know, tempers flared, you know, somebody in the tribe killed somebody else in the tribe, or somebody in the neighboring clan killed somebody in this clan. You know, what you want to try to avoid is this kind of Hatfield-McCoy or Romeo-Juliet thing where you've got this sort of escalating blood feud. You know, we've got to avenge, you know, theirs, and then they've got to avenge back and all that. And so these social currencies were adopted as ways, but very interestingly, not to satisfy the obligation for having taken the life, because in the logic here, there's no amount of social currency, there's nothing that's equivalent to a unique human life. It's really just a way of showing that there is an impossible to satisfy obligation. The badge of this social currency is, we owe you something we can't possibly repay. You know, this is your token. You know, this is your marker. You know, that there's an obligation here that is literally priceless. There's no way to repay. So still not money, but these things are used in exchange system. Okay, now, where it starts to evolve a little bit more toward money is you also have in these village agricultural societies the emergence of a warrior ethos, a warrior ethic, where men will go out and try to raid the neighboring tribe and, you know, raid their crops and raid their women. And then they'll have a retinue of retainers under them, you know, the person, and it begins to create relationships of hierarchy, both in terms if they actually capture, you know, say a woman from the neighboring tribe, that's different than one that you pay bribe price for. You know, you've now asserted dominion over that person, and so that creates a hierarchy relationship. And there's also a hierarchy relationship between the war chief and his retinue. You know, they serve him, he's on top. And so this is the second main basis of human organization after the baseline communism, is the hierarchical lord-vassal relationship of some sort. You know, it's kind of what the Christian Middle Ages were built around. It's what the Hindu caste system is kind of built around. You know, all these ideas that humans have different statuses that are not interchangeable, and you can't, like, rise through the ladder and promote from one to the other. You know, in the Middle Ages, you know, the serf is not going to, you know, become the lord. You know, that he's always on the serf, and so this creates kind of an exchange, and it actually is reciprocal. It may not be equal, but usually in these there is something owed from the superior to the inferior, and something owed from the inferior to the superior, and that is defined by custom and precedent. It's not negotiated. It is part of the fabric. If one village asserts control over the neighboring village, and they pay, you know, 500 chickens, you know, to keep from having their walls torn down, then that becomes the annual tribute. You know, it's going to be 500 chickens next year. You know, you just said, you know, you're not going to go negotiate. That's just the custom. That's the habit. That's the cost of this hierarchical relationship. But we still haven't gotten to exchange, right? The economists theorize that really money involves this exchange, where We're not in a hierarchical relationship. We're not in a communist relationship. You know, David and I are social equals, but we're coming together to deal, to barter, to trade, and we're using money for this means of exchange. You know, we're on the road there, but we're still not there, even through this time. So let's go into the first urban civilizations. When Adam Smith was writing, not only did he not know about the discipline of anthropology or any hunter-gatherer tribes, they didn't know about Mesopotamia, really, because Mesopotamian writing is in cuneiform, which was only, code was only cracked, really, I think, in the late 19th century, that they learned how to translate it. And then all of a sudden, they have a civilization slightly older than the Egyptian civilization, and really the first urban civilization we're able to know anything about. And what you find in Sumeria, which is the oldest layer of Mesopotamia, is that they had a centralized storage facility for their grain, primarily barley. And the grain supply was controlled by temples, which were under authority of priests, the religious establishment, and then a little bit later also by palaces, which were sort of like a temple, but it was the earthly emperor or ruler who was sort of like emulating, you know, the god that was worshipped in the temple. The god that was worshipped in the temple was an idol, you know, and the king would sort of say, well, I'm sort of like, you know, the idol on earth, and so here's my palace, it's like a temple, you know, you need to. But both the palaces and the temples had these stores of grain, and they took in all the grain centrally, and then they rationed it out to the workers. And the workers got two rations of grain a day, or 60 a month, a lunar cycle. And so they invented this measure called the shekel, which is basically the amount of silver, which was kind of a rare precious metal that was durable, the amount of silver that was equivalent to 60 rations of barley. And then that let them, you know, they did more than just barley. They had chickpeas and they had other things, other goods that they used. And so the use of silver as kind of a universal measure of value would let them make their equivalences between, you know, okay, how many shekels, you know, do the carrots cost, and how many shekels do the deer skins, you know, cost. But, and this is where the economists kind of made the mistake, it wasn't like the Sumerians went around, you know, with a pocket full of shekels, and you go and say, okay, I want my deer skin, here's a shekel. No, the shekels all stayed in the palaces and the temples, and it was just the basis of an accounting system of equivalencies. You know, you still weren't really trading, except they didn't have everything they needed right there in Mesopotamia. It was rich in some resources, but not in others. And so they would commission traders to go out to the neighboring civilizations like Egypt and India and so forth, and they would basically give them a stake of goods from the temple or the palace treasury and allow them to go make these exchanges on behalf of the palaces and the temple. And now we do have real barter, but it's not being done by neighbors living in a village. It's being done, you know, between civilizations. And they are, you know, barter kind of turns out to be inconvenient because you've got to, like, have a whole bunch of stuff you're hauling around. You know, you're on the Silk Road, you don't know, like, a knapsack with everything you can trade. So actually, they devolve fairly quickly to credit arrangements. You know, now, credit doesn't work too well if you bump into somebody and you're never going to see them again in your whole life. You know, all you can really do is kind of either, you know, in the primitive society, kill them or trade with them, you know, by barter. But there developed these nodes of traders who would deal with each other. You know, goods would come this way, east, goods would come west. And so you would know the traders in the next village over and you'd deal with them. And so you could keep these accounts, you know. And so now, unlike the hunter-gatherer societies, you are saying, I owe you 60 shekels. you know, you owe me 40 shekels and you're settling up. But you're using the money still mostly for an accounting measure, not so much for a medium of exchange, not so much for something you're handed out. Okay, so to get to David Alkeck's point earlier, how did coins come into the picture? Well, what Graeber finds is that you have, over broad periods of history, an alternation between periods where this kind of credit is the norm. That is, networks of traders, people who know each other, are, you know, keeping tallies, trading with each other on a regular basis, and times when, no, I want the actual metal in my pocket, you know, I want to carry it. And the main distinction between those two times is really how violent it is and whether there is a political power expanding its sphere during this power. Because he mentioned coins came into play in Lydia about 600 or 500 before the Christian era. Lydia was a little city-state in what's now western Turkey across the Aegean from Greece. The coins got adopted from there into the Greek states. And then they were discovered in the Indian civilization, the Chinese civilization, or invented, I guess I should say, slightly after that time. So the idea spread pretty rapidly. And what these expanding governments found out is that it was a lot easier to provision soldiers with coins than it was to try to have supply lines to them to give them all the grain you needed. So if you wanted your soldiers supplied so they could keep expanding the boundaries of the empire, then you would pay the soldiers in these coins, and then you'd tell all the citizens you had control over, they're going to have to pay a tax back to the government with these coins. And the only way you can get the coins is to give the soldiers something they need. And so now, all of a sudden, everybody's busy provisioning the soldiers, you know, so they can get the coins and pay their tax. And the coins, unlike credit, they can be stolen, melted down. You know, to settle an account, a bookkeeping account with somebody, you've got to have enough of a relationship to sit down and, you know, talk about the numbers and go over it. You know, to go grab, you know, a bag full of silver shekels, you just need to be able to grab it and carry it away. So it creates what's referred to as the military slave coin complex that's coming into play. This is a period called the Axial Age by the historians, because it's the period where a lot of the great world philosophies like Buddhism, prophetic Judaism, Confucianism are all coming into play. But also what's happening is the Roman Empire is expanding its borders very quickly. The Mauryan Empire in India is expanding its borders. The Qin and the Han Empires in China are expanding their borders. And to expand their borders, they need these soldiers. To keep the soldiers provisioned, they need these coins. And to keep the coins going, the soldiers need to conquer more territories where they can mine the gold and the silver. And they need to enslave the population so they have labor to mine the gold and the silver. And so it sort of gets into this cycle that feeds itself until there's no more room for these three main empires to expand. If you look at a map about 600 AD, the empires have kind of all expanded and touched each other, and there's not any really land left to conquer. And at that point, the wind starts to go out of the sails of all of them, and this whole slavery coin military complex starts to wind down. Only China, of those three main civilizations, is able to keep any kind of really sophisticated state apparatus, you know, continuously through this period, and they're able to do it because they've established this bureaucracy of the mandarins that are trained in the Confucian classics and are able to kind of operate and organize themselves really independent of who's on top wielding the power. You know, it's kind of what some people call the deep state, you know, in the modern environment. You know, that China had invented the deep state. in about the 6th or 7th century. And it was the resilience of that deep state that let China kind of maintain an empire when what happened in Europe is you went into the dark, what's so-called Dark Ages, and the Middle Ages, and India similarly kind of fragmented into these various principalities and kingdoms and things. So in this period of the Middle Ages, you have several developments that kind of interestingly lead us toward the path of modern money. One of them is that in Buddhism, let me say before I get to that, you know, it's kind of interesting that this period of the Axial Age was so materialistic, and yet it led to all these philosophies like Confucianism, Buddhism, prophetic Judaism. The reason is that those philosophies were fed by and in reaction to the materialism of the age. It was a grossly materialistic age. And then there were some people that said, this just doesn't sit right. You know, this bothers us. And so it was really kind of the provocation of that materialism that led to these anti-materialist philosophies, kind of interestingly enough. But you get to the Middle Ages, and we tend to think of it from a Eurocentric perspective, but the Middle Ages, broadly speaking, you can see is maybe starting in China and India and kind of spreading through the Islamic world and then kind of late in the wave reaching Europe. And Buddhism, invented as an Axial Age religion in India, didn't survive all that long in India, but it found fertile ground in China and became one of the dominant ideologies in the Chinese cultural sphere. And the Buddhists had this kind of long-term view of things, you know, over generations and generations, and they had this sort of world-renouncing view of things. And so they built up this doctrine called the inexhaustible treasury of merits, which is basically, if you would give as much of your worldly possessions as possible to the local temple or stupa, then that would buy you karmic merit. That would sort of, you know, eliminate the number of lives you had to live until you found nirvana. And then the temple would take that money, and they would lend it out at interest because they're trying to grow and make all of the souls into bodhisattvas, and so they need this corpus to grow, and so they're lending it out. And so the first, you know, you can argue, I think, that the first lending institutions that really made loans at interest on a consistent basis were these Buddhist monasteries. And then meanwhile, China is promoting the idea of trade and merchants, but they're not so keen on the idea of capitalism, which are individuals accumulating this wealth that they can make interest off of. But they made an exception for these monasteries because they didn't really consider them people. So the monasteries were able to lend the money. They did everything they could to kind of keep the individuals from becoming wealthy. They wanted them to be trading, but they saw the traders as being compensated for the, really their labor and sort of moving the goods from one place to another, you know, not for, you know, making money off of money. Another innovation that people would be shocked to learn about is that when Islamic civilization came into flower about 700 or 800 of the Christian era, it had to figure out its own relationship between, you know, merchant trading, religious authority, and state political authority. And because of some peculiarities in the succession to Muhammad's political power, which kind of led to the Shia-Sunni split that's still part of the world, Islamic civilization tended to be extremely skeptical about secular power, about state power, but they thought religious authorities, the ulema, they should have a lot of power, and they should promote but nevertheless regulate commerce, trading, but the state should stay hands off. So the original laissez-faire economics can be traced to Islamic civilization. You know, the original idea that these traders ought to go do, you know, what they want to do, and the state ought to just leave them alone. you know, they're still following this kind of religious precept, but it's not really enforced by, you know, by state power. That has its roots in Islamic civilization. Interestingly, the Muslims forbid lending money at interest. You know, it's against. Now, they've got ways around it. They can sell things on time price differential. You can sell for a credit price more than a cash price. And there's some other ways that I'm probably not up on. But nevertheless, it is a real regulation and sort of kind of kept the capital accumulation that was happening in the Buddhist monasteries from happening in the Islamic world. There really was not a lot of, there was a lot of free trade, so to speak, but there was not a lot of accumulation of capital. But by the time Western Europe starts to jump on the bandwagon of this relatively, you know, peaceful compared to the Axial Age time of the Middle Ages, then the church is having to confront the usury issue. I mean the Catholic Church in this case. And they went back to the writings of St. Ambrose, who wrote back in, I think, the 3rd century or so. And he had a doctrine that's referred to as the exception of St. Ambrose. And it's off of a passage of Deuteronomy that says, basically, the people of God were not allowed to charge interest to their fellow, their brethren, but they were allowed to charge interest to strangers. And so it sort of was a matter of definition then who the strangers were. And it kind of oscillated between a real strict definition, well, a stranger is really only someone like a Saracen that, you know, you would otherwise murder, you know, to, well, maybe a stranger, you know, it's just kind of anybody not in your family. And it gradually liberalized.
How about a non-Christian, like a Jew?
Well, yeah, the Jews had their role in, you know, being permitted because the Gentiles were strangers to them. They took the Deuteronomy passage as saying it was okay to lend money and interest to Christians. And but then some of the Christians thought, well, the Jews are having all the fun. So they kind of went for the territory too. And the first Christian lenders at interest were the Knights Templar, who were active from 1118 to 1307. And they were, you know, sponsoring a lot of the crusades that were happening in sort of a way of siphoning off these younger sons who really didn't have any way to fit into the social order. They developed this lending at interest. They were shut down by one of the emperors who was in their debtor. And that was his way of getting out of his debt, was he kind of shut them all down and prosecuted them. So that was kind of the danger of that system. But the cause was taken up by the Italian city-states, by Venice, Genoa, Milan, Florence, were the big four. And they had their own political protection because they were out from under the Holy Roman Empire and city-states and had their own armies to kind of ensure their protection. And they just said, well, you know, we don't think this, no, lending an interest is that important. And so they just started doing it. And that kind of financed what turned into the Renaissance and sort of started us onto our modern path, which kind of takes us up to the year 1450. You know, we talked about these oscillating cycles. And we went from a period of hard money coins during the Axial Age. In the Middle Ages, you're pretty much back to credit because the coins have kind of all disappeared. Interestingly enough, Charlemagne had a system where he was still calculating things in these coins. In fact, the pound, shilling, pence that was used in the United Kingdom until recently was Charlemagne's system. But it was all imaginary. All the coins had still disappeared. But you were still reckoning things as if you had coins. But it was a credit system during the Middle Ages. You go to 1450, when now once again you have expansion. The Spanish and the Portuguese are expanding into Africa and Latin America. the Northern European powers get in, they start expanding to North America, and then all of a sudden you've got the cycle going, particularly when the Spanish find all this gold and silver in Peru and Mexico, and coincidentally the Chinese had just, I left out that the Chinese invented paper money along the way. Paper money originated as a system kind of like IOUs or checks that people would say, well, I can just endorse it. You know, like if I give David something that says I owe you $100, then he might give it to Dave, and then Dave will come to me and say, you owe me $100. And so that's kind of how money got started, paper money got started. But then,
because the emperor backed it.
Well, but then once it got started, and this happened the same in China and in Europe, once it got started, the government said, wait a minute, we're going to control that. You know, this is too dangerous if you're circulating this money. And so, you know, we're going to issue the paper money. And in 1694, the Bank of England, the world's first central bank, was chartered by £1.2 million were lent to the King of England by a consortium of lenders. And in return, they were given a royal monopoly on the issuance of banknotes, which are basically participations in that debt that the government now owes. And the bankers are basically subdividing that debt and, multiplying it. And so that's really the origin of our modern money system, is this idea that you can take government debt and parcel it up into these units of value that people can go trade with themselves, and all you need to do to create more money is really create more government debt. That was really, in fact, it's been said that if that loan in 1694 were ever paid back, that the United Kingdom financial system would collapse, because that's sort of the seed of the whole monetary system, is the fact that that loan was never intended to be repaid. You know, it's intended to create this system of value that can be swapped around. So, in the interest of time, I'm going to kind of condense the modern years, but let's just say that period of 1450, we're now in the expansion period again, and so even though this paper money is being created, the governments have to keep gold and silver reserves on hand, because none of the other governments will trust their money unless they have the right to come in and say, wait a minute, you know, trade this in for some gold, you know, trade this in for some silver. They want that backing. And so that kind of kept a little bit of a constraint on the ability to issue money, because you knew, you know, there's always a risk. Somebody might come and say, let's see your gold, you know, and if you had too much debt, you know, then whoops, you know, kind of got your pants down. But we entered a new era on this cycle in 1971, because in 1971, Richard Nixon, faced by the spiraling cost of the Vietnam War, was forced to rescind the ability of foreign governments to trade in their dollars for gold with the U.S. Treasury. We suspended the ordinary citizens' right to trade in their dollars for gold, I remember the exact year, but around World War I time, basically, when the first central bank was founded. But foreign governments could still come cash it in for gold. Nixon said, this simply, you know, we can't have this anymore, I'm abolishing it. And that is a major change to the world economic system. We now are in an age of purely what the economists call fiat currency, which is basically now money literally is whatever the government wants to issue as debt. We do it through the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve System buying bonds and, you know, financial quantitative easing and things like that controls the money supply. In theory, this would be a time now of not relatively nonviolence, you know, relative trust. But as Graeber points out, it's only been 40 or 50 years since 1971, and this is possibly a 400-year cycle that we're on the front end of. And so maybe we've only just barely scratched the surface of what it means to live in a fiat currency world. You know, there really is no restraint on the U.S. government's ability to print money except its own concern for the possible ramification of ceasing to be the reserve currency of the world, because when Nixon took out that ability to get gold, then the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency, basically the replacement for gold in terms of what, you know, everybody else wants their money convertible into. And if we got too reckless, you know, with just issuing the dollars, then we could jeopardize our status as the reserve currency. It's argued, and Graeber argues, that the other thing that backs up our reserve currency is our military power. Because if you ever got into a monetary war or a trade war, it could escalate into a real war, and the country that has the most ability to bomb every square foot of the planet, which the U.S. military does, is the one that people will tend to say, I'm going to bet on that country, and I'm going to let their currency be the reserve currency. So that kind of brings us, I guess, up to current day, so I guess I'll just pause there and see what questions might come up.
You can see how he knows his history. Any questions? And please make them as questions. Yes.
I wonder if you had any comment on cryptocurrency.
I'm relatively unschooled in cryptocurrency. It's a fascinating phenomenon. It kind of scares me a little bit because it's a fiat currency that is not backed by any kind of sovereign power. And you know, if Graeber's theory is that you know, debt comes first and money is basically the measure of debt, and you know, I'm not sure who's backing that debt. You know, I kind of understand who's backing the debt of the U.S. dollar, but I'm not sure who's backing the debt of cryptocurrency.
I agree with you. I think it could collapse and disappear anytime. Anytime.
Theoretically, you know, living on the government can do this money supply just continually expand and except for the fact that, you know, that other countries might not choose to use the dollar, for example, as state reserve currency. But isn't an even bigger fear that democratically elected government, which most Western powers are, the bigger fear is that not only do you have a high inflation during a four-year period, and it's pretty much got, you know, just even an approach towards double-digit inflation rates got rid of harder, but also an additional impact of that inflation is that once you get floating currencies, then one government can grind out as much as they want, but then anything that they try to buy from other countries, it goes way up in price because their dollars, their currencies might help. And so that further increases the inflation rate of the country and means that 4 years later that government may not be there. I mean, I think that's a bigger threat than the kind you mentioned as far as that.
That's a good point, Bob. It's something I kind of glided over in my talk. I probably should have put that in there, but you're exactly right. Another consequence of how much money is put into circulation is it affects the balance between debtors and creditors in the private world. And debtors benefit from an increase in the money supply, and creditors benefit from a tight money supply. And throughout history, governments have been manipulating that balance. Back in the Sumerian times, they had a term called amargi, A-M-A-R-G-I, which is basically when they put a forgiveness on all debts. And they would do it occasionally when things tended to get out of whack and it got too one-sided. We talked about this hierarchical relationship. You know, and one way a hierarchical relationship can get created is when you become a debt peon. You know, when you have debts to people you can't satisfy, then you sort of become the vassal, you know, lord relationship, basically, with your creditor. And in ancient Greece, they had to wrestle with that because what they found out is if they put their peasants under too much debt pressure, they really weren't interested in serving as soldiers in the Army. And so they found it was easier to kind of give them some relief and let them be free peasants if they would be soldiers than it was to impoverish them and have to go hire mercenaries, you know, who probably didn't have their heart in it the same way. And in the Bible, we have this concept of the Jubilee. You can argue whether Nehemiah in 400 B.C. or so actually instituted the Jubilee, but he might have. And we don't have anything quite that drastic, but there are definitely political implications in wealth distribution in the money supply, and that is the political angle. It is true that we could print as much money as we wanted to and maybe not lose the reserve currency, but everybody that owns bonds, you know, something like that, they'll be relatively worse off. People that owe a whole lot of money on their credit cards and their cars, they'll be relatively better off from that process.
That's why the dictatorships go nuts, because Zimbabwe, Latin America in the 70s, and so forth, they can have whatever inflation they want to create, because they want to.
Doesn't a lot of it have to do with credit and your debt and is the expectation that the economy is going to grow, that there's going to be some profit, that there's going to be some promise of some return. And the reason I read that usury was such a sin, it was one of the seven deadly sins during the Middle Ages, is that there wasn't any expectation of growth, that it was going to be next year's, the same as next year's, the same as the next year's, the same as the next year. So to charge interest would wreck the whole feudal system. If you don't mind, you know, talking about how a nation or a king or whatever, his ability or his promise to keep his debt, to pay the debt, you know, would increase his credibility, his credit rating, more or less. And that's why the United States has a good credit rating, is that we are able to, you know, pay our debts, even though we don't, but we are able to.
Yeah.
So if you could get it.
Yes, thank you for that, because that's another subject I kind of skipped over. I mean, there's so much here you could go, but that's definitely worth coming back to. So the word interest is from the Latin interes, and I was mentioning in the Middle Ages sort of the wrestling the Catholic Church did with, you know, whether charging interest was legitimate or not. And one of the steps along the way is they decided, well, if you just charged for a loan being late, that wasn't the same as charging for the loan in the first place. So if I lend you $100 for a month, I wouldn't charge you any interest for the first month. But then you didn't pay me back for a month. Okay, well now, you know, now we're talking, you know, interest. The original meaning was being late, you know, late charge, so to speak, not use of the money. And yes, you're right, that the concept of interest sort of assumes a growing pie, you know, one way or another. And, you know, we've had that growing pie at times in our history, you know, through things like the agricultural, the grain revolution that increased crop yields. You know, we have the industrial revolution that created, you know, the productivity of human, you know, power. We've had the information age revolution, you know, now. And, you know, as long as you continue to have those increases in productivity, then there's the ability to satisfy that interest somehow, you know, and bring more back than was let out. But if you ever stop that growth, then that's going to put more stress on the debtors, because you're demanding that they bring back this increase, but there's no underlying part of the economy to find that increase in. And so you're more likely making them debt slaves, more likely putting the pressure on to get that amargy, that jubilee, that something that, you know, or otherwise you have the rioting in the streets. It's all part of the same picture.
Question? I was wondering, again, I understand from a practical standpoint why metals, gold, and silver have been used so much. But it seems that it's often gone beyond just the practicality of it, and there's something mystical about it. I know when I was an attorney for the Federal Reserve Bank, I had a fight with a lot of Ron Paul followers, even though the Supreme Court addressed the issue of legal tender, paper currency as legal tender back during the Civil War. We were still fighting with them over paper money. And I was wondering what is so mystical about metals, gold in particular, that a large percentage of the population seems to think that it's so important to use metals.
Well, there definitely is a, I think you could use the word fetish even, that you're sort of a fetish about, it's all chemical. The alchemists were also part of the mix in the Middle Ages, and gold represents the sun, right, because it's shining, it's bright. Silver represents the moon, because it's reflective and like a mirror. And so, people do sort of see this magical, resonance with the cosmos, the heavens, in it. And some people, I would say, have a gold fetish. But, I think ultimately, though, gold, you have to say, what's the real utility of it? I mean, it has some utility. You can make little rings out of it and things. But probably not as much utility as
the thing about metals is that it's not like wood or something that's destructible. It's there. And silver and gold, of course, are noble metals, but they don't rust.
There's certainly practical reasons for it. But
gold is completely impractical. I mean, it's too soft to make tools with. It's only pretty.
Scarcity.
Well, that's one thing, but it's pretty, and then old diamonds are more valuable, but whatever. You mentioned florins and the florins, the florin became the coin of the Middle Ages because the bankers, the Medici were so good, and the florin became the coin of the whole Mediterranean. But when Marco Polo came back from China, and he gave his little report to the Duce and whatever, and he said, in China they use paper for money, and they laughed at him. Paper? What good is paper? It's not worth anything.
Yeah, Weimar Germany, they ran around a bushel basket full of money because it lost value terribly. We have a world back currency now, we have a world currency, but yet we're $21 trillion in debt. And what happens if it gets worse and the rest of the world doesn't buy our currency and they want to change it, and we'll be like Weimar Germany, that's what I'm afraid of. What do you think?
Certainly, I can't rule out the possibility. I mean, you could certainly inflate yourself out of credibility, as a government. There's no question.
You ready?
Come on, this is a subject. Very good, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
What do we have